we are with Ken Stringfellow and John R. The Posies. So, how are you guys doing so far?
We're surviving. I think that's good enough as a start.
Definitely. I know that, I guess you had an interview with a friend of mine, Justin Fielding, mm-hmm. who's doing the Power Pop movie.
Yep.
And what I wanted, and he probably asked this of you, but I'll ask it again. Mm-hmm. Are you comfortable with the term Power Pop as a descriptor of not all of your music, but some of your music?
I guess I better be, because it seems to be there. It seems to say something to certain people, and if that's the case, great. I mean, I just think of us as a quirky indie rock band, you know, intellectually quirky rock band, a la XTC or something. Who I don't consider a power pop band, XTC, but some people might in certain instances, yeah, depending on certain songs.
Right. There's a lot of people who like that kind of quirky pop. They're power pop fans, and they just kind of gravitate towards the other bands that basically have similar types of melodic approaches.
Yeah, it's weird though. I don't know why certain bands get tagged with it and certain other bands seem to get away with not being tagged with it. And, you know, I mean, for better or for worse now, we get, that's kind of on our, you know, it's going to be in our tombstone. Probably power pop bands, probably when the Posies aren't there anymore. But I mean, you know, look at other bands, like, I always use the example of like the Foo Fighters. I mean, now, they have a lot of stuff that can be considered power pop.
Absolutely.
I think, but no one ever calls them a power pop band. And why is that?
Yeah, I mean, they're much more straightforward in general, their songwriting, than ours is.
Yeah.
And for me, there's a, like in the power pop, if you like in describing power pop as I understand it, the music should be relatively simple. Like, mm-hmm. there's you're trying to write the perfect 1-4-5 song, something like this.
Right, you know? Yeah, with a bridge that takes you in. And
well, and power pop implies, I think, a certain set of parameters too, like and kind of limitations in a way. I think like you gotta have these things to fit the bill, basically. And I think a lot of what we do is outside of those parameters, really. Well,
particularly on that, on your last album, Solid States had like a lot of electro pop and a lot of different, you know, instrumentation that you had not done before.
That's true. And I think even, for instance, what cracks me up is when people refer to Frosty on the Beater as being one of the greatest power pop records of all time. And I'm like, have you listened to the second half of the record of Burn and Shine? That's a power pop song? I mean, you know, How She Lied by Livy. Coming Right Along is power pop. Now, granted, we've got Flavor of the Month. And,
right.
But even like Solar Sister, which people call power pop, there's more going on in it than the typical, you know.
Absolutely.
Pop, pop, pop.
Like 30 years later,
yeah.
I mean, is there still a big creative fire going on between the two of you? I mean, as far as like putting together the music, is there still like you push each other the same way you did when you were younger?
Well, I don't think it's the same way, but I think we do still do that. I mean, for instance, Solid States is an example of, I mean, you know, that record was pretty much made just Ken and I trading things back and forth and pretty much allowing each other to kind of do our thing on each other's songs, you know, and it's amazing how well and easy it tends to work, you know. Just very rarely did Ken ever send something back to me that I was like, I'm not sure about this, and I think vice versa with him. So something is working still.
All right,
I
great.
Think.
So you still have fun recording and writing and doing all the stuff that you're doing now. It's still fun to do. It's not like a drag or...
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
They're much more... I mean, I could be working at Amazon if I wanted to, like, work and get, you know, and make real money. You know what I mean? I mean, we do fine, but... I don't know. You'd have to have a pretty weird attitude to come to a point where making music is a drag. I can't really imagine it. Unless... I mean, I guess if you were, like, playing cover bands and after a while you might get, that's like, you know, one step away from being
from burning
an artist,
out, yeah,
you know, like in a sense, so like you wouldn't actually be an artist,
right.
But it's, you know, like I would say that the way that we make music both together and separately is these days, I mean, I just think we're better managed project managers in a sense. I mean, the only regrets I have about some of our earlier work is that we just weren't very efficient. We didn't really you know, we didn't know exactly what we were looking for, in a sense, because that's part of becoming, I think, a greater artist, is that you start to, you're free to explore and go really wide, but you have the ability to get that idea and capture it with more skill and more accuracy. And in our earlier days, it was harder to get things and capture them, because we didn't, you know, we just didn't have much experience. You know, it takes time.
Great. What I was going to say is you did play with the great Alex Chilton, one of your heroes, for a long time.
Yeah.
Is there anything you learned from him specifically to help you grow as a musician?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think he was good at illustrating that sometimes it was better to let things be rough around the edges and not to get too, you know, precious and finicky about what you were doing. I mean, in the studio, that was kind of his role, and we actually were doing those recordings we did together that became In Space. He was more about, you know, picking the moments that actually felt like they were going to fall apart a little bit, instead of, you know, the ones where we'd actually polished it and kind of, you know, learned it, you know, and maybe had gotten a little bored with it at that point or something. He was the one going back to the earlier takes of things and trying to remind us of that. So that was a good lesson for us, especially, you know, I mean, for me, so I can definitely get into that kind of, I'm going to just work something over and over and over into maybe, you know, the nth degree. So that was a good lesson to learn.
Okay,
sure.
Cool. If he was still around and still with us, I mean, do you think you'd be still playing with him? Do you think he'd still carry on the Big Star band? Or do you think he was, you know, slowing down at all?
I think he was just getting going, in a way. Yeah. Big Time would probably agree with that.
Yeah, I think he was really enthusiastic and starting to get a little more comfortable with the whole thing, I think, and himself.
Right. It took. I've read his autobiography. It took him a long time to accept that people were still interested in Big Star after, you know, all that time.
I think a little bit like what I was saying about the power pop thing, you better get used to the idea if you're us, is a little bit like him. I think he finally just realized that he couldn't will it away, people's interest in the music, you know, and whatever he thought about it. Because he didn't really have very great things to say about Big Star's records. You know, he wasn't particularly proud of them in the way he described it to us. Yeah. It's funny because I've also heard, you know, stories from Chris Stamey where Alex, you know, had periods where he was really proud of the music to some degree and enthusiastic about it, even in the 70s.
You know, really?
Like he kind of just... He's the definition of what we call mercurial, really. He really had could change moods and stuff like very extreme.
Yeah. And sure. what an odd trajectory too for Big Star. I mean, it's got to be strange to, like, I would imagine, to like have done all these records, put all this work into it, and not gotten any attention really.
Right.
And then, you know, years later, suddenly everybody's like, "Hey, we want you," you know. And he's kind of like, "Well, where were you then?" You know. I can see his point there.
Absolutely. I think I was told that your older albums or some of your older catalog is going to be coming out again, or is it being remastered?
It is being remastered, actually. So the Dear 23, Frosting on the Beater, and Amazing Disgrace are going to be re-released by Omnivore Records. They're starting to come out in the spring. We have a Pledge Music campaign going right now.
Oh, okay.
Which would be great if you can link
to
that.
Yes, I will definitely link to that. I will have that up there. Is there going to be like additional tracks, rehearsals and failed experiments?
You know, it's not so much rehearsals or even like, you know, like boombox, you know, recordings and things like that. It's actually like some pretty legitimate like outtakes and a bunch of really well-crafted demos. I mean, I think on Dear 23, the number of bonus tracks is like 27, like bonus tracks, and I'd say at least half of them have not been released before, which is pretty impressive, I think. And Frosting is the same way. There's tons of great stuff, and some of it we didn't even remember doing, you know, in the first place. I was just shocked to find like full band versions of songs that,
really?
Yeah, like there's a version of the song Throwaway that was on Amazing Disgrace.
We did with Don Fleming
for Frosting on the Beater, and it didn't make it. And that's not going to be on the Frosting outtakes. That shows you how much stuff there is that we decided to leave that off, you know. So, anyways, it's definitely not us just scraping the bottom of the barrel trying to repackage, remaster to make a buck. It's definitely like a...
It's not trying to scrape the bottom of the barrel. It's actually effectively scraping.
Effectively getting the getting what you need.
We did it.
That people want to hear, which is excellent. One thing that I wanted to ask is, you did play and on Ringo's album, Time After Time.
We did not.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
The guys from Jellyfish played on it.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, actually, he just recorded the song of ours. Like, we did Golden Blunders.
Okay.
And he played drums on it.
Yeah.
And also, I think Andrew Gold, you know that?
Yes.
He plays the guitar. And Waddy Wachtel
is
on
Bob
it.
Bob Glob is the bass player.
Yeah, it's a pretty impressive little lineup there. Peter Asher produced it. So.
Yes. Yeah, no, it was a wonderful lineup. And I was wondering if you were involved in it at all. No.
It was a total surprise. In fact, we've told the story before, but basically, we were in L.A., and somehow in those days, like, word got around that you were in L.A. somehow, you know, and like somebody called over to Geffen and basically said, you know, heard you guys are in town. Can you like make it over to Peter Asher's office? We have something we'd like to play for you. And we're like, okay, sure. So went over there and, you know, sat down in an office and they put that on. That probably is the all-time biggest mindfuck of my life, like to hear a song from your band sung by one of the most recognizable voices of music that you loved so much, with no warning. You didn't. It's not like even as we're walking in, they're like, "Yeah, we think, you know, we're pretty excited about this. We think you'll like it." And we're like, "What the fuck are they talking about?" You know, and then they put that on, just like, "What."
It was some serious Twilight Zone shit.
Yeah, I can believe that. I mean, it's. I guess my last question officially is there anybody that you wanted to record with, play with, that you haven't experienced yet, that you haven't done anything with?
I always thought it'd be interesting to work with Brian Eno, of all people. That's somebody I think would have been, you know, a great choice for us to do something kind of a little
imagine his
different.
Rhythm section with your melodies. Wow.
I don't know. I mean, I've just always admired him, and, you know, and some of the records I love that, you know, many power pop folks might not think I would even listen to, probably. But like Remain in Light, for instance, by Talking Heads is like one of my like top 20 records. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. So, Brian Eno.
Do you have a person, Ken, that you're thinking of?
My dream in life would be to, and we got close, huh? Would be to make music for a Wes Anderson film.
Oh,
that would be right. That would be my dream in life. We actually did a song. We actually did a Beatles cover. We did the demo version of "I'm Looking Through You."
It's on the anthology, right?
Yeah, and so they wanted that for a scene, but they couldn't get the rights to it. So Randall Poster had us record it. Note for note, and it's a great version.
It's a forgery almost.
Yeah,
what it is.
It's pretty incredible, actually.
Yeah.
Where can people hear that? Or you
actually, it was on
Mojo.
Put out. They had a Beatles issue, and they gave a CD of Beatles covers with the thing. So it's somebody's probably posted it online somewhere.
Okay, we'll find it.
If you do check it out, you got to check out Isaac Hayes' version of something. That is just like, whoa! It is. Crickety crazy. It's 11 minutes long.
Wow.
It's one of the most insane pieces of music I've ever heard.
So let's drop acid and listen to that and the Isley Brothers' Summer Breeze together.
Sounds great. You guys will have a great show. I know for sure. I appreciate the interview. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
Housies.
Thanks.